I don't even know how I have 40 followers on Twitter, to be honest with you.
We're talking sports.
I got two.
Oh, you have two now.
With a couple of guys you've never even heard of.
I don't really understand it. It's crazy.
It's Moving the Goalposts. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, review, and tell a friend. Moving the Goalposts wherever you listen.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to Moving the Goalposts. I'm your host, Nick Mara, joined by my co-host, Mike Masala. Mike, how are you now?
I'm doing great, brother. How are you?
Not so bad. We're also joined by producer extraordinaire, Andrew Meehan. Meehan, what's up?
How we doing? Happy Marathon Monday.
Happy Marathon Patriots Day, right?
Patriots Day.
It's the Massachusetts only celebration. So, Mike, you get a day off today, as you get today anyway. But, you know, we'll celebrate Patriots Day with you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Glad to have you guys here.
If there's one thing I don't understand, it's why Massachusetts is the only country, the only state that celebrates Patriots Day. And what is Patriots Day?
Oh, you're going to put me on the spot with Massachusetts history. I honestly don't know.
It's got to be revolution related, obviously.
It's definitely like soldier related. And in that ilk, and obviously, with the revolution happening up here, a lot of the main battles anyway. So I think you're right with that.
I wonder that aspect. Maybe it's like the Boston Massacre or something, or like the Boston Tea Party, one of those things.
You'd think we would learn about that in school, but
what Patriots Day is?
Yeah, I don't know if we did that. All random right. One holiday that we get.
All right, you children. Patriots Day is an annual event formalized by several state holidays commemorating the battles of Lexington, Concord, Monotomy. Am I saying that right?
Monogamy.
No, not monogamy.
Oh, okay.
Monotomy.
Happy Easter.
So, some of their first battles in the American Revolutionary War. You Mike, children.
You had it. Mike had it. He was like, it had to be something with the battles around here. That was exactly
yeah.
It.
Yeah, we nailed it.
Oh, what a battle. What a battle they fought back in 1776. What a battle the Celtics fought against the Nets yesterday. Game one of the first round. Celtics come away with the 115-114 victory over Brooklyn. Buzzer beater, Jason Tatum. Storyline of the game, though, has to be Al Horford. I was not expecting him to put up 20 points and 15 rebounds.
I mean, yeah, he kind of, they showed before the game that they put up the Bruce Brown the quotes on the Jumbotron saying that we're going to go after Al Horford. We're going to go after Daniel Tice. And Al Horford, I mean, he showed up.
Held his own.
He definitely held his own. I did not expect that either.
I would make the argument he was one of the top three players on the court between both teams yesterday. I will have to say, though, the best player on the court was Mike's guy, Kyrie Irving.
It was just so entertaining. He's so fun to watch play basketball. Like, there are some great players, like James Harden for me. I obviously recognize he's a great player in the NBA. I can't stand watching James Harden play basketball. It's not entertaining to me. Kyrie, from what the stuff he does on the court to the interactions with the fans, flipping them off, telling them to suck his dick while he's walking out back into the locker room. I mean, the last time he did that, the Celtics got really good. So I don't know why he would do that again, but it was just so fun to watch. And I don't think Celtics fans should be mad about any interaction that happened yesterday. Like, if you're giving it to him and he's giving it to you back, and he's also performing on the floor. Like, it was just so fun, the whole experience watching it.
Andrew, what were your thoughts on like how the crowd interacted with Irving and how Kyrie kind of like gave it back to them?
Yeah, I mean, what do you expect? I think of all the sports, we see it the most with basketball because the fans are right there. You know, like we've had it when we're working. You know, the URI games over at the for WHJJ, you can like, it's bad because you can't tune them down sometimes, but you know, like Mike said, we were talking about this, you know, before we started the pod, you know, if you're dishing it out, you got to be willing to, you know, take it back. And Kyrie's a guy who's going to, you know, give it back. Now just don't do anything stupid, like throw a water bottle again or any of that, you know, any of that crud, but you don't want to throw, you don't want a malice at the palace type, you know, ordeal.
No,
going
definitely
down. Not that I think Kyrie would do that, but I still hate Kyrie. I'm not going to say that he's a bad basketball player. He's a great basketball player. I just think he's personality wise, he's a total phony fraud.
Mike, it's a lot like you said, he's good for basketball. And whether or not he thinks that he's a villain or he's embracing that he's a villain, he plays the villain so well. And that's exactly what he was doing in game one yesterday. I mean, his first three quarters were, you know, he was playing well, but it was mostly a, a Boston dominant performance up until on and went into a zone that nearly won the game for them. I think though at the end, and we can talk a little bit about the buzzer beater and whether or not they should have called timeout and all that type of stuff. But at the end, with Brooklyn's last possession, it seemed like he was trying to dribble out the clock and just end the game on his own. So I wonder if maybe the crowd getting to him, that was his response and saying like, F you guys, I'm going to take this. I'm going to end it. I'm going to do it all. Oh, wait, they're double teaming me. Oh, I got to get rid of the ball with 0.3 seconds left on the shot clock. Okay, here you go, Kevin. So maybe it had a negative effect on Irving, but it seemed like his performance yesterday was just unreal.
Just from everybody, I think you get to play against two of the best players in the NBA when they're on. Kevin Durant, Kyrie Irving are two of the most entertaining players. And you got to see that down the stretch. For some reason, they were getting left open. They were going to double team other players. Like they were covering Bruce Brown and leaving Kevin Durant wide open. I don't know what the Celtics were thinking on some of those plays, but they were able to step up in the final minutes. And as we start to transition to talking about the buzzer beater and that play, I was talking to Andrew before we started recording, old Marcus Smart, he takes that shot. he takes that shot with two guys closing in on him.
The most Marcus Smart thing that Marcus Smart could possibly do is take that shot.
I think Jaylen Brown probably takes the shot as well. I mean, the ball movement all around on that final play is sort of a picture of how this season has progressed and how they've grown since the beginning of the year to where they are now. That's a game that you don't win. And it's not just because of the ball movement, the thing that they struggled against throughout the regular season, even when they were playing well, close games, they were winning all the blowouts, but any game where they were going up against opponent that was giving them a hard time and it was a close game at the end of the fourth quarter, a lot of times they were finding themselves losing those games instead of winning.
It kind of looked like vintage, early in the season, last season Celtics too, when you go up 13 and then in the third and you start blowing the lead again. That's something that has happened to the Celtics so frequently in recent years that I was like, this is exactly what's going to happen. They're going to go and lose this game. And luckily they were able to stop that bleeding. I don't think that they should have taken the timeout. I'm just never it gives both teams a chance to reset. Yes, you get to drop a play, but you're also giving the other team to reset, take a second defensively. When you're going down there, just on your fast break, on your transition, having the option to maybe a guy makes a mental lapse on defense. We've seen rotations go so poorly, especially in recent history. You've seen defensive rotations, people not covering one guy, leaving him open, leaving open for the pass, going two guys closing out on Marcus Smart instead of one.
Right.
Just one tiny thing can happen there. But I could see where people would be saying that as well.
So there was 10 seconds left to go on the clock when Horford grabbed the rebound?
I think so, right around there at least.
See, I think with there being such a small amount of time, but not too, you weren't in a position where if you were going to inbound the ball from half court, you were only going to have 2 seconds to take a shot. And then in that situation, I think you have to call a timeout. If there's a lot of time left on the clock, if you're closer to 20 seconds than you are to just 10 seconds, I think you take a timeout as well because you want to make sure that everybody is on the same page as far as we're going to move the ball around, we're going to kill the clock, we're going to try and get a good look, but we're not going to just chuck it and shoot it as soon as we get the opportunity to, because if we miss it and they rebound it, game's over, all that fun stuff. I don't know if that was something they had addressed beforehand, because there was a timeout with about, 33 seconds left to go. And that obviously could have been something where they discussed, we need a score, we need a stop, and we need a score. And depending on how much time is left on the clock, we're just going to run it. And I think that Udoka is probably not going to get a lot of credit for making that call, but I put all of that on him. His game management at the end was spectacular.
And that's something that I think Brad's been kind of criticized over in the last recent years, especially he was known for being this guy who could draw up plays, but it was more of something that was said than something that was actually happening. I feel especially in the last couple of years when he was the head coach, Udoka deserves a ton of credit. And I saw that they've released, and I'm not sure if you guys, we can do a, do you guys care about this discussion in a second? the coach of the year, top three, Udoka wasn't in it. Like,
yeah, I saw that.
That's kind of crazy to me.
Coach of the year in the NBA is the, it's weird. It's like it went to Greg Popovich for so many years, and then like Nick Nurse won it back to back seasons. Like he won an NBA championship, and then he won Coach of the Year the following season again. So I don't know how they determine who wins it. But talking a little bit more about the final play, and you, Mike, you were saying that so a lot of times when the clock is expiring and you're not taking the time to settle things down, defensive rotations can get messed up, and that's almost exactly what happened on this play where Tatum's driving to the bucket, and the only person that's really guarding the paint is Kyrie. Mm-hmm. So he's got the size on him. He's got the skill on him. And the move that he made to avoid all contact and finish at the bucket was perfect. Andrew, to me, this begins to put Jason Tatum on another level, having those premier plays, those highlight reel plays, those plays where when you say the person's name, that's something you think of. And I think before this, if we were all going to say, what is Jason Tatum's number one moment in the NBA, it probably would have been dunking over LeBron in the Eastern Conference final. I think this probably supplants that.
Yeah. I mean, when's the last time that we got excited for a Jason Tatum play in the playoffs? This is the most excited I've been about a Celtics team heading into the playoffs in a very long time, because it's just been the kind of the same story, or they somehow trickle in. You know, last year they were in the play-in game and then they got, you know, bumped out by Brooklyn. So now they're back in it. You're second in the East. You got to have moments like these. And this is only game one. I made a comp to this being like Bruins Capitals last season.
I know, oh, yeah. Oh.
Crossing sports, but that was a Stanley Cup in its own, and that was again the first round of the playoffs. So it's going to be a very, they're not, you know, not done yet. That's only game one. So there might be more moments like this. I mean, there was another moment last night where Tatum had a three, like when he was, I don't know, maybe 2 yards in front of Kyrie, and he just got right over him. There's a lot of things to be excited about, and that was, oof. Yeah, chills on your spine.
What do you guys think the impact of Robert Williams in last night's game would have been if he had been healthy enough to play? Do you think the game would have gone very differently? Because even though Durant scored 23 points, it's not like he really had a great night on the floor. He was 9 of 24 from the field, only 1 of 5 from beyond the arc. It was really Kyrie that took things over and got the Nets back into the game and ultimately, you know, almost won it for them. I don't know if Robert Williams adds a dynamic right now that is going to make this Celtics team a lot better against Brooklyn, but if Durant and Irving are both on top of their games, then yeah, I think it's going to be difficult to slow them down without the Time Lord.
I mean, I don't know about you guys, or go ahead, Mike. Sorry.
No, you're good.
I don't know about like you guys, but I loved what I saw from not Robert Williams. Jesus. Oh my God. Batman. Who am I thinking of?
Grant Williams.
Getting my Williams mixed up. I like what I saw from Grant Batman, Williams against Durant last night. Durant looked awful, and especially in the first half, he was getting his pocket picked left and right on multiple back-to-back possessions with the ball. Robert Williams would have added a bigger presence in the paint, obviously. I think Horford sufficed for that last night. Tice was, you know, attracting fouls, which some of them I thought were bull, but you know, it's Daniel Tice. The war
I was just
on
about
Tice
to say
continues.
That's what happens with Tice.
Yeah, but I love their defense. There's pressure all over.
And with Horford, like I was tongue in cheek at the beginning of the show saying like Al Horford was the best player on the court. This is a guy who, like, I was listening to the post game interview that he was doing because I was driving home from Easter listening to the radio. And he was saying, like, a year ago, I was back in Atlanta taking my kid to kindergarten. Like, he wasn't even on Oklahoma City anymore because they told him to go away. They were winning too much with him. So you talk about, like, a 180 on where this guy was a year ago to where he is now. It almost seems like Boston was the only place that he would be able to rejuvenate his career. And yeah, I don't know how much of a career he's got left. I mean, he is an old guy.
Right. He's in a good situation. Last night, I mean, looking at the stat sheet after the game and seeing he had 15 rebounds was crazy.
Like, right.
That's not necessarily what you think of Al Horford. When you see Al Horford, that's not necessarily the statistic you associate with him. Like, I think Robert Williams probably takes a good amount of those. But I think what Williams' impact would be more of Tice's minutes, I think, in my mind, especially when he starts getting in foul trouble early. And at least that's a little bit more of an inside scoring presence. And Horford has that little mid-range game that he's used pretty well, and he does have the ability to hit the three. But I think like Robert Williams is the better interior offensive player. And I think that's where that would have impacted. And maybe you wouldn't have seen, I don't even think he had like crazy points or anything. Like Drummond only had like 8 points. Claxton had like 13.
Claxton was good defensively. He had a couple of key blocks.
He did. But I would like to see those guys against Williams, where at least he is more of a chance to grab some of those balls.
Sure. Yeah. And I think, you know, looking at the Celtics stat line on their box score, you've got 4 out of the 5 players that not only scored in double figures, but they scored 20 plus. Mm-hmm. Like the Celtics' best players showed up last night, and they're the ones that were the difference in the game. And some people may have been critical of Udoka during the regular season by shortening his bench a little bit too much and only playing 8, 9, 10 man rotations, which you really do only see in the postseason. 8 guys got into the game last night, and Peyton Pritchard only played 8 minutes. So, I mean, he has pretty much decided, I'm going to run with the 6 or 7 guys that I trust. And, you know, I always want to have one of Jaylen Brown or Jason Tatum on the court. And Tatum played 45 minutes last night. So, I mean, he was on the court the entire time. And they're young guys. They should be able to play like this. There's no need for load management when you're under the age of 30 in the NBA, in my opinion, at least, if you're also not 7 feet tall.
Right. And you're not playing back to backs at this point. So you have the nights off. Also, during the broadcast, they mentioned last year, and this is how like quick and also weird time has been. They were like, oh yeah. And this is Jaylen Brown's first playoff appearance in 2 years because he missed last year's playoffs. I was like, I completely forgot about that. I completely forgot that they didn't have Jaylen Brown because he had that injury at the end of the season.
Yeah, I totally forgot about that as well.
Time is weird.
Going forward in the series, though, how do you guys think things are going to shake out? I mean, I don't think it's going to be Boston in 4, but I also don't think it's necessarily going to go 7. I like the idea that you can get Robert Williams back by like game 3, game 4. And the rumors and speculation about Ben Simmons coming back for Brooklyn, to me, after watching yesterday, he's not going to fit on this team.
No, I don't understand that because Robert Williams, like you've had him in for a majority of the season. Ben Simmons is something completely new. Like that's a completely new dynamic. You're going to have to learn how to play with this guy. He's going to be more open than he ever was in Philadelphia somehow. And he's still not going to take shots. So like I'm very interested to see if that's the route that they choose to go this postseason, that would be crazy to me. For the rest of the series, I feel like the Celtics are going to win the series, and I feel like it's more 5 or 6. I don't think it's going to be a sweep. I don't think it's going 7. I think it's kind of like right in that sweet spot. Brooklyn probably wins a game or two at home, and I think we should be able to take care of it.
Andrew, are we being too confident?
No. Oh my God, no. I think if you could get Williams back by what are they saying now? Game 3, game 4?
Yeah, I think about the middle of the series is sort of what they're shooting for, but there's no guarantee yet.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think you got to send a message and go 2-0 in the series before you head to Brooklyn, because now it's a different ballgame. You know, Kyrie's allowed to play in Brooklyn, and which would you guys be surprised if, like, you know, Governor of New York was just like, oh yeah, you know, we'll free up the vaccine mandates by then. Sure.
No, that's literally what happened. What the mayor of New York City did was he lifted the mandates for professional athletes and celebrities.
See, I didn't know this because I just, it hasn't swirled around my head.
How fucked is that, though? Like, how, like, could you imagine actually being someone who's like, you know, I can't take the vaccine because, you know, whatever reason, health reason, but yeah, I'm a city employee or I work in the city and now I can't go to work or whatever. And I got to find a different job. Meanwhile, Kyrie Irving, because he's a public figure, just like okay, you're a celebrity an athlete. Yeah, it's what the literature actually says is for celebrities and entertainers.
Ridiculous.
I mean, if we want to go on a deep dive rabbit hole about the mayor of New York and how he says he's a vegetarian but has to keep denying questions that he eats fish all the time.
That's a vegetarian. Vegetarians are allowed to eat fish. It makes no sense, but
it's a weird, he has a weird story. Like he keeps showing up randomly in the middle of the night at like these burnt down houses and stuff, like these crime scenes. He's just the first one on the scene. It's a very weird time happening.
Probably the one committing the crimes.
I'm not saying, but I'm saying.
conspiracy files.
Nothing like the governor or the mayor of, I think it's the mayor of Los Angeles, who is like telling people, oh, every time I take a picture, I'll remove my mask and I'll hold my breath. No risk. See?
Pretty good.
Going back to Robert Williams, I think it'll add a bigger presence in the paint. But again, I liked what I saw from their defense last night. Was it a close game? Yes. They edged him out. Yes. But, you know, it was more than what I thought I was going to see from guys like Horford and Tice.
Yeah.
Without Robert Williams. And, you know, hey, it was bulletin board material going into the, I mean, if you want to call it that, I'll call it that. When, you know, they were calling him out and saying, oh, they got Horford and Tice. It's, you know, practically just alluding to the fact that they're second stringers and everything. But, I got to see how the series goes. I mean, if you can go up 2-0 in Boston before you head to Brooklyn, I'd feel a little bit more confident and not to rush back. Cause I mean, I'm a Celtics in six guy. I think they can finish the series in six games, but I won't be in it. If it goes 2-0 in Boston before they head to Brooklyn and I give Brooklyn like one game, I won't rush Williams back.
Yeah, I agree with that. I like that take. Any final takes on the series?
So it's going to be the most entertaining series in the NBA playoffs right now. It's got to be.
I agree. It makes the first round meaningful. Mm-hmm. You know, people talk about like in the NBA first round series, everything wraps up super quick because the teams are not really matched up well, unless it's like a 4-5 or a 3-6. You're not getting that in this 2-7. You're getting two high end legitimate, you know, I'll say championship contenders, because somebody has to come out of the East to contend for the championship.
Right.
Moving on, though, we got a baseball game that's actually getting started right now. Good morning to those of you who are listening live somehow. The government, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
100% the government.
Oh, absolutely.
But the Red Sox seem to have turned things around after starting the season losing the first two games and 3 out of 4. They've won 4 out of the last 5, including a 4-0 and an 8-1 victory over the Minnesota Twins. Marathon Monday today, you got Rich Hill taking the mound against Minnesota. I don't know if you guys were aware of this, but I guess Rich Hill lost his father over the weekend. And this is going to be his first start, but he made emphasis to say, like, you know, I want to make this start. I want to, you know, honor my father, that type of stuff. So probably a storyline that not a lot of people know about going into today's game, but something that should be interesting. And really the guy that I want to talk about is Michael Wacha. Like through his first two starts, he's been legit.
It's almost like it's like 2013 again. Like we said that before the season started, they have all these guys who were names at one point. If Wacha can keep this up, like maybe you don't need to add an extra arm. I mean, obviously it's definitely a stretch. It's definitely a stretch.
Yeah.
But he's looked really solid so far. And I don't think the bullpen's been as big of an issue as we thought it could be.
So the bullpen has been a little bit of a surprise, but I don't have a lot of long-term faith in them. And that's what happens with bullpens. You'll get one guy that's hot for a week and then he'll go cold. And then you want to make sure that you don't use him. You use the guy that's doing well. And then when he goes cold, you keep flipping things around.
Right. But I feel like that's the case with every bullpen. Like every year, every team goes in, oh, we're going to add a bullpen arm at the deadline. Like that's what every team says every year. So I don't know. I don't like to get too worried about that. What I am worried about is how good they are in the yellow jerseys. Like just make it the full permanent jersey. They're too good.
Andrew, did we talk about the yellow jerseys last year on the podcast?
Oh, we had to have.
I think I've changed my take because after watching the game on Jackie Robinson Day and seeing a Red Sox team without Red Sox, I'm out on any uniform that doesn't have Red Sox for the Red Sox. That's crazy. Like, just put Red Sox on these uniforms. You'd be fine. It's not that big of a deal. You don't need to wear the yellow ones.
I'm going to be honest with you. I did watch the game on opening day, obviously. What were they not wearing Red Sox? I didn't really
know. No, this was on Jackie Robinson day. They were wearing, like, so some of them were wearing Red Sox, but like Kiki Hernandez was wearing like the special Jackie Robinson socks. They looked like they were blue. Camouflage.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay. I didn't really notice that. But,
We're talking about legitimate, the actual socks. I thought you were talking about like on the front of the jersey, how it, like the yellow jersey say Boston on them.
Oh, no. I'm talking about the socks. Okay. The color of the socks are not red in those uniforms.
Right. See, that's the problem when you're named after a piece of clothing.
Oh, the White Sox don't even wear white socks. They wear
this is crazy.
Socks.
What are we doing now?
What does any of this mean?
Such a bad argument. I mean, the yellow jerseys, yeah, I like them. I get the point of them. I don't know. Just wear them on marathon day, and then that's
it. I agree. Yeah, like, wear them.
They're not even wearing them today.
They're wearing
the Boston jerseys today.
Right. They're wearing the actual Boston Patriots State jerseys.
Yeah. Okay. So that, yeah, I don't have the game on in front of me. I don't want to turn my head to my TV for for another 20 minutes. But no, I mean, I don't know. I like them. I say this with the utmost respect. Utmost respect, because obviously we all know what they're for and what they commemorate. But yeah, I'm actually even happier that they're wearing the ones with Boston, you know, Boston on them today. That's the iconic moment. It says Boston, doesn't say Red Sox.
So taking a look at the rest of the rotation, though, I don't think that adding Chris Sale is necessarily going to, like, the more and more I think about him coming back, the more and more I'm realizing you're pretty much going to be adding a number three starter. But if you can get good outings out of Eovaldi and Houck at the top of your rotation, and then maybe find a way to acquire an arm and develop him. Like, I am looking at this team as not really a World Series contender, but a little bit more of like a bridge year, similar to last season, where you can get players better and get players, you know, a little bit more growth, and you're building up your farm system, but you're still able to compete at the major league level. And that's why you don't want to move on from someone like Bogarts just yet. And you don't want to move on from someone like Devers just yet. But once you fall out of it, or if you fall out of it, then yeah, you've got some pieces that you can move on from that are going to set you up for a very, very good future. They're currently second in the AL East, and this year is going to be an absolute slugfest. You got Toronto at the top of the division at 6-4, Boston's 5-4, and then Tampa Bay and New York are both 5-5. Like, four teams going to be separated by probably less than five games all year long.
I just want to say how tragic it is that the Yankees got a 12 strikeout, 5-inning, 3-hit performance from Nestor Cortez yesterday with no runs, and then they lost 5-0 to Baltimore.
Yep.
That's tough.
Yep.
That's a tough way to lose it.
It's almost as tough as Michael Wacha not getting credit for the win yesterday.
It is.
Like, you beat the shit out of them 8-1. You go 5 innings, you don't let up anything, and you don't even get credit for the win. You know, and we had mentioned earlier about how it seems like if you're going to continue to be competitive throughout the year, obviously you're not going to want to move on from Bogarts. I think it was late last week, we actually heard our first offer that was made. It kind of leaked out that the Red Sox, and explain this to me, was it a 4-year extension or was it just a 1-year extension that brought his number up to like $90 million?
Yeah, it seemed like it was the latter, because I think he already has, if obviously he can opt out, but I think he already has 3 years on his deal remaining. Hmm. So it was just like tacking on an extra year to make that annual value look better. That's disrespectful. We're starting. I'm sick of the Red Sox doing this thing where they expect their players to take crazy discounts. It reminds me exactly of the John Lester situation. Like, it's like, I think it was the same number too. I think it was like either 70 or 90. And it was an offer that they thought was disrespectful, so they didn't come back to the table and put together another offer. That if you're going to do that with this guy, like, what are we doing here? It doesn't make any sense to me. You guys have the money. You guys are clearly going out and paying things and buying other teams, and you guys have the money. So stop nickel and diming on your best players. Nickel and dime over Kevin Plawecki. Nickel and dime over Michael Wacha. And you're giving $10 million to James Paxton. He's not going to play for the first half of the year.
But I don't think that it's nickeling and diming over someone like Bogarts. I think it's them realizing, what do we do in 2 years when Marcelo Mayer is ready to go?
That's a bigger thing that you hear from fans is like, oh, we have such a good farm system. We have such a farm system. Like, I'm sick of hearing about the farm system. Like, that's great and all, but like, we're talking about guys who are face of the franchise, you know, face of the franchise level type players. Like, I mean, we could argue and we could debate later on who would you rather keep of the two, Devers or Bogarts. I mean, that's just an age thing. You'd obviously, maybe you take Devers over Bogarts, but you know, look at the guys that they've gotten rid of. They've gotten rid of Mookie Betts.
I mean, I think with Betts, a lot of it had to do with he was going to cost a lot of money. I don't know how badly he wanted to play in Boston. I don't think you get that at all with Bogarts or Devers. I think both those guys want to be here. I think both those guys take pride in being Boston Red Sox. I think both those guys understand that this is kind of a good place to play a major league career. You can have a lot of success and you can have a lot of fun. The concern for me, it really just comes down to when you're spending money short term, that's fine. But if Bogarts is looking for like a 7-year contract, it's going to take him into like his mid to late 30s. How much is his production going to drop off? Because there have been a lot of times now where we've seen the Red Sox sign guys to contracts and they don't look awful at the beginning. But once they take that sharp decline, it's like, ooh, this is bad. Who was it that they had signed? I don't really consider Sandoval because he was never really good for them. But an example along those lines, trying to basically avoid the Jacoby Ellsbury deal, where he went and signed for like $20 million a season for the Yankees and maybe played 150 games in his career there.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely a tough situation. And like, baseball contracts are so weird in that aspect anyway, where the last 2 or 3 years of every baseball contract, especially the long-term ones, like it feels like everybody knows that you're going to be paying for some bad years. And that's kind of the way the business has worked in that sport. But there's also been some whispers, some talk. I don't know if any of it's substantiated, but there's been talk about if Bogarts isn't here, does Devers want to play here? Like those are two guys who have Devers has grown up having Bogarts as his leader and his like shepherd into the game of baseball in Boston. A guy who he obviously can speak the language with, and has shown him how to be the best version of himself, the best version of a baseball player in Boston, professional, how he plays at the plate in the field. If he leaves, that could take your chances of Rafael Devers into free agency with him. Like it's they're riding a slippery slope right here. And I'm somewhere in the middle. Like it seems like Andrew is anti-farm system and that is certainly one way to look at it. And I feel like I don't put my eggs into every basket because we've talked about it a couple weeks ago. Like you'll see your Lars Andersons and your Henry Owens, Brian Johnsons, all these guys who get pumped up. But there are good prospects that come up every year. Like that's an obvious statement. Eventually, especially these guys at the top of the farm system, I would like to see some of them at least make it up to here in Boston. And it seems like from what everybody's saying, the Marcelo Meyers, the Nick Yorks, the Tristan Casases, these guys seem to be pretty legit. And we've heard that again every year with all these guys, but I would like to see some of them up. So I'm not anti getting rid of Bogarts, but I would like to see him stay here.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. It's like hedging a little bit, but you have to, there's a way to make both of those things happen.
I don't want Bogarts to leave, but I understand that they've signed Trevor Story and he's pretty much a Bogarts replacement. And I also know that if they're a team that wants to save money but still compete, then they are going to be using their farm system a hell of a lot more. And they lucked out with that Mayer pick. Like this was the kid that a lot of people were saying was the top prospect, but because I think who was it? Pittsburgh figured they weren't going to be able to sign him. So they drafted like a catcher or something. Like you lucked into that selection. does it kind of handicap you now? And it makes the middle of your infield a little bit of a log jam because you've got two stud major league players that are already on the roster. Maybe, but I would rather have too many guys that can play at the major league level than not enough.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're looking at someone like Bogaerts, who's spent his entire career in Boston, he's 29, be 30 going into free agency. I just think that there's this fear of that decline, that he's going to drop off, that we've had him for 10 years. We won two championships with him. He was great for us, but we feel that 4 years, 5 years, 6 years from now, we're going to be better off with somebody else at the position than he.
I think that's fair. And it's part of the business. And I think that's probably why Heim Bloom was brought in here, to make those smarter decisions, I guess. But there's nothing stopping you from saying it 4 years is probably your shortest term deal, I would assume, coming into this is 4 years coming out. I would give him that 4 year deal, because coming into what you said, he's 29, so he's coming into his, he'll be 33 that final year. I mean, guys play past that all the time. He won't be playing shortstop by then. If they do re-sign him, he'll either be moving to second base, third base, DH. You have a lot of options there. I would do that, and specifically just because, like, this is the guy who has been the ultimate team player for this team. He's helped a lot of these guys grow up, and he's done everything you've asked of him, and he's done it to the highest level. I think he deserves to be paid what he should be paid, and I give him that 4 year deal. And then after that, you come to that and you make that decision. I'm way more comfortable walking away from a 33-year-old Xander Bogaerts than I am a 29-year-old Xander Bogaerts.
So saying he deserves to be paid what he deserves to be paid, I agree with that. But I don't think a lot of these guys deserve to be paid over $30 million a year. Like Tatis, I can see because he's young.
Mm-hmm.
Lindor, I can see because he went to a team that is under new ownership and that guy wants to spend trillions of dollars. And with Correa, I look at him as really the outlier. Like, that's a very good Bogaerts comp. I'm not spending that much money on a guy that, but last seasons were not as good as he was, you know, 4 or 5 years ago when they were banging on trash cans.
Right. No, I get that. And the market is obviously booming for shortstop, kind of like it is in wide receiver in the NFL, where you start to see this money and it starts getting crazy. I just feel like you got to do what you can to keep that guy right now, especially after losing Mookie Betts. You've already upset a good portion of the fan base. You don't want to do it again.
Oh, yeah. Lord forbid they upset the fan base. What's going to happen? People are going to stop buying tickets, stop going to games, stop watching on TV. That's what we tried to do 3 years ago, and it didn't work.
That's fair.
Andrew, any thoughts on the Red Sox, state of the Red Sox?
No, I mean, I agree with everything that Mike said. It's Bogaerts is a guy who deserves to be paid what he paid. I mean, 4 years, $90 million, it's insulting. And I know it's kind of like that. What would we say, that 1 year? You're kind of just fronting
it's
him
like a
some 1 year
money. Extension. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I get it. But to me, it's like you're potentially going to be trading away. For Bloom, you got to keep one of the two. You've got to keep Devers or you got to keep Bogaerts. Every fan's dream would be to keep both, obviously. If I had to pick between the two, I want to keep Devers. And he's the one who really, they both in the last couple, in this home series, in their home opener, they've begin, you know, they're continuing to show that those contracts are just insulting. Bogaerts started in this home opener and Devers showed it his first at bat of the season, for Christ's sake.
Yeah.
Bogaerts has really turned it around. He was like, what, 2-17 at the bat at the plate before coming home. And now he's had was it an RBI double yesterday? I know he had an RBI, but was it on that?
Didn't he hit a home run?
Yeah, a home run on Saturday, I think.
Yeah, on Saturday he had a two-run homer. Yesterday he had a double and an RBI. But he's turned it around. So,
mm-hmm.
And I wasn't blaming him for his output at the beginning of the season so far at the plate. guys probably a little, you know, disgruntled and frustrated, especially because, you know, you're hearing it at the press conference too. They're, you know, everybody that has to deal with this is getting asked those questions. You know, I was watching the other day with Cora. I think it was either after the home opener loss or on Saturday after the win. You know, Cora was dodging questions too. I'd have to ask Xander about that. So
what do you guys think is more important then for the Red Sox, the value, the total value of the contract or the average annual value? What do you think is, if they were going to give up on one, which side do you think they would give up on? Because I'm looking at the top contracts for shortstops in the majors right now, and they have it sorted by the value of the deal. And Lindor is at the top of the market. He's making $341 million over the course of his contract. Tatis is second at $340 million. And in fifth place, it's Trevor Story at $140 million. And his average annual value is 23.3. So, I mean, I would probably value Bogarts higher than Story. But I wouldn't put him, again, I'm not giving him $30 million a year. I just don't think that those players are worth it.
Yeah, I think ideal for the Red Sox would be, like I said, a 3 or 4 year deal at that $28 million number, which that seems to be what they've made it look like here on the $90 million offer. That's what they want, and I think Bogarts wants the AAV. It's tough. It's a negotiation for both sides, so obviously that makes sense that both sides would want something different. But I don't know. I would do what I can to try to keep that guy happy. Like me and said, if I had to choose one, it would be Devers over Bogarts, but I would love it for them to be both.
What if you worked in, I mean, obviously his contract right now has all those opt-outs, which is why we're having this conversation. If you were able to work in a deal or work a deal so that he's making an average annual value, it's still not $30 million. It's south of 30. So like you said, 28, 29, 29 and change, whatever. But you let him have an opt out after every year. So kind of like what you did with JD Martinez, where if he feels he can make more money on the open market or he just doesn't want to play in Boston anymore, he can go. Because for average annual value, it's Carlos Correa, who's 2 years younger than Bogarts, at 35 a year, but he's only signed for 3 seasons. Right. Lindor's contract and Corey Seager's contract, like those are two contracts that are like, that's where you need to be. Right. Get out of the 30s, stay in the high 20s, mid to high 20s, and figure out how long you want to sign for.
Yeah. I guess Tatis is probably a little lower because they bought out so many years of like his arbitration and all that stuff. Cause he's only been in the league for 2 years and they already gave him a crazy extension like that. When that stuff happens, that's you do tend to get it for a little less, but you're obviously paying them sooner.
It's what the Rays did with Wander Franco.
Right. And it's like the Braves, like what they're doing with Ozzie Albies and Acuna and getting them to sign crazy cheap deals.
Soto will be right around the corner in Washington.
Right. So you get a little bit of that there, but yeah, like I said, I think that, yeah, 25 to 30. And I think the higher end of that is where Xander deserves to be paid. And I would definitely do a deal like JD's deal. Cause at least from the PR perspective, and this is what the fan base would look at it and say, this is a guy who's making $29 million and he didn't want to stay here. Like, mm-hmm. I can't really blame the team if he's making his market value and he didn't want to stay here and he wanted to opt out or he wanted to opt out and get a longer contract. I can't blame the team or the player from that perspective, I guess.
Yeah. It's either a good thing or a bad thing that Bogarts is hitting free agency the year after all these shortstops were on the market making massive money. But either way, the writing seems to be on the wall on how Boston wants to handle him. And it's unfortunate, but we'll continue to enjoy him for the remainder of this season or up until the trade deadline, at least. and we'll go from there. Any final thoughts on the Boston Baseball Club?
I don't want to make this a long thing, but just interesting that Tanner Houck's not pitching in Toronto.
Yeah. So because Canada has the strict COVID regulations, you have to be fully vaccinated, or you just have to have one vaccines?
I don't know their specifics. It might just be one. But he came out and said that it was everybody's choice. And I honestly think you're going to find there's going to be a few guys on this team that have that same belief, and that you probably won't have your full complement going to Toronto anytime soon.
Yeah, no, they kind of alluded to that last week, that there were going to be some players that were going to not be brought along, and Plawecki tested positive for COVID, so he's not even on the roster right now.
Mm-hmm.
I think with a pitcher, though, if you've got a starting pitcher especially, that's not the worst thing in the world. Do you want one of your better arms to go against a division rival and someone that you're going to be competing against for a playoff spot? Yeah. But early in the season, I think to manage the workload, you can move him around. You don't have to bring him to Toronto. You can have him start the first game of the next series, wherever that might be. So I'm not super worried about it, but yeah, if we're talking like postseason or like games that you need to win, where you need to be there, then yeah, I mean, I'm all for people having a choice and whether or not they want to take the vaccine. But now I've gotten to the point where we're like 2 years into this and there's not a lot of negative stuff that's come out.
Right.
So I don't know, but it's everybody heals differently and lives differently, I guess.
It's fair.
Well, gentlemen, I think that's going to do it for another episode of Moving the Goalpost. But before we end today's episode, does anybody happen to have a final blow?
Not a final blow, but I just saw the Thor Love and Thunder trailer dropped about an hour ago.
I'll have to check that one out. I was going to say mine's movie related as well. I get to enjoy the Batman 3-hour extravaganza whenever I want now, because it's starting to stream on HBO Max.
So
if you haven't checked it out yet, now you can do it for free. Mm-hmm. Well, not for free, but
right. Well, you gotta go to the movie theater alone.
You get it. Yeah, you don't have to go to the movie theater alone.
Didn't plan on it. Did not plan on it because I don't have the courage to do it.
I'm telling you, it's the best place to go.
It'll be the day that I run into like everybody I know, and they're gonna be like, "Who are you here with?" And I'm gonna be like, "My date's in the bathroom."
And it'll be like, you know, I'm here to watch a fucking movie where you can't talk to people anyway. Be quiet and watch a movie. Oh, you want to talk about the movie afterwards? Okay.
Mine is also movie related. I just bought my tickets to Doctor Strange, so I'm very excited for that movie.
All right. Someone has to explain to me what the Doctor Strange movie is about.
How
is it connecting into what's been going on? Because I rewatched Far From Home or No Way Home last week, and on a second viewing, like, it's good, but it's not.
Wait, where'd you watch No Way Home?
I bought the movie.
Ah,
yeah. But on the second viewing, I was kind of like, this was a good movie, but it was a lot of fan service. It was sort of like an ode to nostalgia. And I don't think that the Doctor Strange movie is going to do that. So it's got to move the MCU forward, but I just don't know what they're doing.
I think it just has to do with the fact that they've now altered reality a few times between WandaVision and this past Spider-Man movie. Mm-hmm. And now everything is kind of going to shit because of it. And I think that's kind of where they're going from that. And then you'll probably start to see a lot of weird things. We saw, I think, what is it? Is it Evil Doctor Strange from What If, whatever it's called? I don't know if you guys watched What If, but Dark Strange or whatever his name is. He's looked like he was in the trailer so far. So you're going to get a lot of interconnecting, I think, from a lot of these shows and the movies. I mean, they've got me so hooked on everything that they do. It's great. Like, I'm watching Moon Knight. I'm not loving it, but I'm watching every episode.
I haven't even watched it yet.
Right. This is going to go straight into Doctor Strange, which is going to go straight into Ms. Marvel, which is going to go straight into Thor. And like, you just got me 24/7, 365. I'm just consuming your content and you got me locked and loaded. It's unfair.
I have a final blow. The return, the premiere of the final season, the first half of the final season of Better Call Saul is tonight.
Ooh. So
for anybody that's a Breaking Bad fan that hasn't watched Better Call Saul, the first season or two can be a little slow, but then it picks up and you're basically watching Breaking Bad like 6 months before Breaking Bad happens.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I still have to get caught up on the most recent season because it just got on Netflix, I think, last week.
Yes.
I'm very excited for that as well.
Yeah, I think two or three episodes left to go in the season, and then I'm all caught up. So
let's go.
So that is my final blow. But gentlemen, that's going to do it for today's episode, episode 78 of Moving the Goalposts, a number that I think has been retired by the Patriots. So might be a little difficult.
But who was it
retired for?
Bruce Armstrong.
A 78. Okay, a Bruce Armstrong 78. A 78. I want to say like a Steve Hutchinson 78 from the Minnesota Vikings, or maybe a Walter Jones 78 from the Seattle Seahawks, or was he 77?
You know who I think was 78 is Jackie Slater. I think Jackie Slater was 78.
Hall of Fame Jackie Slater. 78.
Oh, who was the defensive lineman? Bruce Smith, 78.
That's a good one. Buffalo.
A lot of Bruce's wearing 78. It's a weird Bruce
Michael
number.
Michael Sam was 96.
Mm. Yes.
78. A Greg Hardy 78 with the Cowboys?
I think so.
Or with the Panthers even?
I think he was 78,
that one,
yeah.
That one I'm going to have to check because I'm seeing 76.
Disrespect
as well.
On that number. Greg Hardy.
76 in Carolina, 76 in Dallas.
Mara, so you were wrong.
I was going to say, big Greg Hardy fan.
No.
Loved everything he did on and off the field.
Oof.
Oh, 78 is a tough one. 78 is a tough one.
It's a tough number.
But episode 78 of Moving the Goalposts, as always, we want to make sure that you guys are following along throughout the week. You can catch me on Twitter at NickMara94. Masala can be followed at Mike_Masala. And producer Shortenair, you can follow him at MeAndA_83. Gentlemen, Mike in particular. Till next time.
Later, brother.
Peace.